The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gap Fest live from Melbourne edition. It's Wednesday, June 7th, 2017. On today's show, Wonder Woman is not the first superhero movie to feature a female lead, but it is being greeted as a breakthrough, not only for the lead character, the title character, but for its plausibly feminist themes and for being helmed by Patty Jenkins. And then, stop all the clocks, cut off the telephone. In a matter of minutes, Melbourne's own Courtney Barnett will be sitting to my right, answering my questions, standing to my left, playing.
Yeah.
And I am only reading the words written down here, playing and discussing her fucking kick-ass music. I love Courtney Barnett. All right. And finally, Michael Williams, the director of The Wheeler, who you just met, Wheeler Center, will join us on stage for a freewheeling discussion about travel, stereotyping, and how we form our cultural perceptions of place, i.e. what is it about Americans and kangaroos? Joining me today is Slate's editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hello, Steven.
Should we dig in? Wonder Woman has been in development purgatory for years, maybe as long as a decade, but it finally hits the grand, giant, global multiplex this weekend. It stars Gail Gadot.
Is that how you say it?
I went on the internet because I knew I was going to fuck it up either way, and I think...
That spoils the thing in my head of just... thinking of it, the whole movie as G'day Gadot. Ever since we saw it. G'day Gadot.
That joke came pre-ruined, but as she stars Diana, she's never once referred to as Wonder Woman in the entire movie. And the movie is down the line an origin story. Diana, I'm sure I do not have this right. Diana is the daughter of Zeus, and she's being raised as a member of a hidden tribe of Amazonian warriors.
No, she's the... What the hell, dude?
They said...
The whole plot of the movie is that she's the not the daughter of Zeus.
What?
Oh, no, wait. It is... Oh, all right, continue.
I'm the one who repeatedly fell asleep in the screening, Julia. She's still a young demigoddess in training when an airplane crashes into the nearby ocean, thus intersecting the sapphic playland of her childhood with the real world, with World War I and with Chris Pine, not necessarily in that order of priority. We'll get to the gritty specifics in a moment, but first, let's listen to a clip.
Please slow down, Diana.
That's your leader? How could he say that? Believe that? And you, was your duty to simply give them a book?
No.
You didn't stand your ground. You didn't fight.
Because there was no chance of changing his
mind.
This
is Ares, and he's not going to allow a negotiation or a surrender. The millions of people you talked about, they will die.
We are going anyway.
You mean you were lying?
I'm a spy. That's what I do.
How do I know you're not lying to me right now?
I am taking you to the front. We are probably going to die. This is a terrible idea. We're going to need reinforcements.
All right. What percentage of this room is going to see this movie?
Wait, clap. You have to clap for broadcasting.
Well, don't make them decide until they've heard our segment.
Oh, well, there we go. All right. Well, I'll begin with you, Dana. This is a noble gesture, right? But let's separate out the social nobility of the movie and its feminist, you know, possible feminism from whether or not the movie's any good. Did you like it?
I very much liked it. I would say with a few squeancy reservations that we'll get to later, I loved this movie and was completely surprised at how much I loved it and was thinking that, you know, I mean, I think anyone who listens to our show regularly knows how burned out I am as a critic on writing on superhero comic book movies. There are good ones, there are bad ones, there are in-between ones, but when it comes down to it, there is a sameness to them. And I think this movie breaks out of it pretty impressively. And I did go in thinking, well, at the very most, this is going to be a sort of you go girl experience or something like that. And I was actually moved. I cried at least twice.
I thought you cried.
Did you hear me
cried.
Whimper? There was a little moment. Julia was sitting next to me in the screening and I was getting sniffly and I sort of went.
I did.
I got a little sniffly too, but it was an apnea snort.
Yeah, I mean, I will get to some of the reasons why, but the overwhelming adjective that occurs to me, and this is probably going to end up leading my review of the movie as well, was delicate, which is not something that you would often think about a superhero movie. I mean, Gal Gadot herself has a sort of balletic grace to her that is not your typical kind of busty pneumatic. She's not like a Linda Carter kind of, you know, I don't know. She's not the comic book shape of a woman, and she has a delicacy in her performance. And the movie itself has a kind of delicacy. And I know that that sounds strange in relation to a big, you know, DC blockbuster, but didn't you find that, Julia, as well?
I loved this movie. I feel like one of the things this movie swirls about in a gigantic muddle, a lovable muddle, is the notion that women deserve equality because they are the same and they are human, and that women should rule us all because they are noble and better. And
right.
I definitely think the second idea is wrong, 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 wrong. And so delicate is like raising a hackle for me, because I think there's a part of this movie that suggests that Diana, because of her womanhood, is truly peace loving and wants to bring peace to mankind in a way that made me feel a little bit squeancy. Mm. But the movie has more subtlety and moral complexity than these movies typically do. You could basically argue that this is a movie about like interventionism versus isolationism, that it takes place. So the original origin story of Wonder Woman is that she comes out of this kind of timeless all-female warrior island, rescues this pilot, American pilot, and enters World War II, and that's where she enters the
World War One.
No, but in the original origin story of the character is World War II. This movie shifts it back to World War One. And so it's basically a movie about chemical weapons. Like, it's a movie about mustard gas. The evil doers in the movie are trying to murder innocent women and children. It's like essentially a movie about Syria. Like, the moral conflicts of it are basically the moral conflicts facing the nation, like the world right now. And it doesn't shy away from them until the film's final act, where the truly motivating rage is not the death of innocent children at the hand of weapons, but, potential risks to Chris Pine. But for much of the movie, it like fairly seriously contemplates all these issues while being very beautiful and fun. And I will say, as someone who is ambivalent about, superhero movies generally, I also cried at this movie. I cried at the opening scene, which is like a founding scene in the character in the history of the comics too, where she rescues this pilot. So the pilot, his plane crashes into the ocean. He's being pulled under the waves, and she pulls him out of a plane and she rescues him, and she uses her strong body to save his dying one. And I just wept. Like, I've never seen that. And I was like, how is it fucking possible 100 years into Hollywood that I've never seen this before? And I also, it made me realize, like, oh, maybe this is why people like superhero movies, because they get to see themselves be really fucking strong and awesome. And why has no one ever shown me that before?
Yes, I had the exact same reaction. And I had a moment of thinking, you know, I think, well, obviously, right? If what we're used to seeing in superhero comic book movies or the comic books themselves is always big strong dude faces off against other big strong dude, then it, of course, it gets boring after a while, right? The question is just which of the two big strong dudes is stronger. But as soon as you put someone in that equation who is not usually in a position of fighting a big strong dude, it completely changes everything. And I started to kind of understand what had seemed to me kind of simplistic debates about representation. I wasn't sitting around thinking, oh, boo-hoo, I need to be represented by a superhero, you know?
Yes.
But it was sort of like an itch that I did not know needed scratching. And I didn't cry at the rescue of Chris Pine, but in very similar scenes, in moments when essentially, yeah, the physical might and also moral might, because she is quite I suppose you could say she's kind of a goody two-shoes of a heroine, you know, in the Superman DC tradition, but she has a kind of moral righteousness that you see in that clip that we showed. And that really really moved me too, that she wasn't dark and brooding and kind of exploring her dark side. She was someone who was against war, was trying to end war itself, not just this specific war. And there's some interesting and I think fairly complex stuff late in the movie where she and Chris Pine get into arguments about, well, are we trying to just end this war and solve this problem? Or are we trying to, as she says in that clip, you know, kill the god Ares and thus put an end to war as an institution?
Backing up a little bit though, Julia, how would you compare her technique in rescuing Chris Pine with Dwayne The Rock Johnson's technique in rescuing the guy, like neck, in terms of neck support?
And well, he would just, it was unlikely that he would have had a spinal injury from that. I think she did better than The Rock. while we're on the subject. but I also think that Gal Gadot does, or what is it? Gadot? Gadot?
Gadot.
Anyway, she, Gal, Wonder Woman, does a remarkable job with performing the goody two-shoesness and naivete of this character. I mean, she basically has to play sort of like the woman child naive, like the power naive who comes to the modern world and is like, what's this? You know, it's sort of like Ariel and the Little Mermaid, like telephone, like teacup, like she's so perplexed. And yet she doesn't play it as a ditz. And she retains this kind of vitality and moral clarity that isn't always,
she's really good.
Simple to apply. Yeah.
No, she's really good. All right. Can I levy two complaints about the movie?
Please. Are we going to let men talk in this segment?
Apparently not, but. but here they come. So, jokingly on a radio show yesterday, I said, I'll judge this movie on one metric, and that's whether it comes in at less than $1.20 in 120 minutes, knowing full well that it was going to be closer to 240 than 120. Like, there is something about the genre, the superhero genre. I mean, the business model essentially changed, right? In the old days, you told an interesting story. You got it in at about 90 minutes, maybe 2 hours. It was tight. It was crafted and brought the audience along with it. And now it's really about entering a world, right? Making a world this enormously appealing place so that fanboys and girls go the opening weekend in order to re-enter the world. And plot and craft seem to me to be extremely incidental to that business model. And so you, in order to go along with this genre, you have to really like large, baggy, sort of out of control, vaguely plotless and chaotic movies that end with a 40-minute bludgeon fest, right? And so in that sense, it for all of what was non-traditional about it from a feminist point of view, it's incredibly traditional in terms of what the state of the genre is. But the second thing I would ask, and this I say this tentatively, right? But, you know, how healthy is it for anybody in the first place, regardless of gender, to derive any sense of self or agency from superhero movies, right? You could make an entirely gender studies style argument about how young men have been destroyed by like these ridiculous ideals of being huge, muscular, and beating the crap out of your enemy. Is it so simple to say that it represents a form of progress to extend that paradigm to your gender? Oh my God. Who are you? Raise your hand.
That guy is inspired by you, Steve. That guy.
Well, I love the dead silence from the rest of the crowd, though. You know?
I mean, I guess the thing that was striking to me about it, like Dana, I had no craving for this. I was not sitting around. I mean, there were people on the internet being like, when are they going to make a freaking Wonder Woman movie? How can they possibly put out another non-Wonder Woman movie? What's wrong with them? I was not among those people. But you do get to see powerful women on screen wielding other kinds of power. Not as many as men, probably more in the last 10 years than in the 40 before that, probably. But it's familiar to see women exert power of persuasion, power of being, you know, emotionally savvy know-it-alls, but different kinds of power you do get to see them exert. The power of like just sheer physical ability, capability, and strength. It was like a jolt, a representational jolt that I didn't know I wanted. And yes, I guess if all I ever got was that and I never saw women be capable in any other way, that would be a bad outcome. I think we are fairly far from that day.
Yeah, I guess, and the only thing I would add is that, I mean, it's to ask that question when finally a movie comes along that represents a group that never gets represented in that huge slab of popular culture, and suddenly to say, oh, let's rethink the entire superhero movie. You know, I mean, like, it would probably be a great thing for our culture if we had far fewer tentpole blockbuster movies, period. It would definitely be a good thing for the film industry if there weren't so many of these movies on which the rest of the economy depends. But given that that machine is churning along, it doesn't seem the worst thing to me that little girls are going to buy Wonder Woman costumes
at
the store and, you know, feel empowered, to use a wildly overused word.
Of course.
And I think that this movie does, because it does make her this kind of morally mighty as well as physically mighty person,
yeah,
that it is more than just a bludgeon fest at the end. I completely agree the movie's too long by at least 20 minutes, and that, yes, that kind of generic scene in which various baddies, in this case, they're sort of two baddies succeeding each other, get blown away in some way is boring. We've all seen it before. And that feels like it's fan service, and it's a thing that you have to do because it's a big superhero comic book movie.
Yeah, that's where Wonder Woman must point her lasso of truth next, is like, she's against war, but what she has not yet conquered is the arms race of the third act battle.
Mm-hmm.
And like, the just dumb third act battle, and you have to have a big long one, and that's where the CGI comes in, and there's flying metal, and you zoom through the fire, and the guy, you think he's dead, and then he comes back, but he is dead. Like, they just, like, every single one is the same and they're boring. And I actually disagree that the first two thirds of the movie is a lot like other movies. I think probably it's a little similar, mm-hmm, to the Captain America ones that have kind of the retroness and the earnestness.
Yeah, it's a romance. It's a period, yeah, romance. I mean, that scene that you see.
This movie really changed you, didn't it? I can tell by the vigor with which my devil's advocacy ricocheted back into my own face. And by the way, Melbourne, I noted how vigorously you applauded her comment over between you and me. I see who you really are now. All right. Well, the movie's Wonder Woman. It's everywhere. Go see it. Come to facebook.com/culturefest and tell us what you thought of it. All right. Moving on.
Hey, listeners. One note before we go back to our amazing Melbourne show. You are about to hear our segment with Courtney Barnett, an amazing Australian musician, who, I should say, I am disappointed in all of you that I was not taught about Courtney Barnett by any of you in our summer struts of summers past, because her music is eminently struttable, as you will soon learn. In any event, submissions for the 2017 Summer Strut are closing this week. Please send them in by Friday, June 9th. You can either submit them on our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest, where there is a special thread dedicated to Summer Strut songs, or you can tweet them with the hashtag Summer Strut. Thank you again for your submissions and for listening. Summer Strut always results in a great playlist for all of us, so please do your part. All right, back to Melbourne.
Courtney Barnett put out a couple of EPs about 5 years ago, and from that point on, her life as a musician and a songwriter, I have to guess, has been something of a blur. Some things are just too good not to notice, care about, and share with everyone you know. Her music is one of those things. She broke through in our little country with her debut album, Sometimes I Sit and Think and Sometimes I Just Sit. That was in 2015. It somehow is just such a great record. I mean, I love that record. It's somehow both conversational and filled with bedazzling wordplay. It's somehow melodic and yet knows how and when to drone. She can patter and talk sing with anyone, but when my very discriminating, no bullshit 11-year-old daughter heard the very first bars of Depressed, she leaned back in the backseat of the car, closed her eyes and said, "Ah, oh, that voice." Anyway, why lard it up any longer with adjectives and words from me when we have her improbably right here in the building? Please welcome to the stage, Courtney Barnett.
Hello. We should look out further.
I guess it wouldn't hurt us. We don't have to be around all these coffee shops. Now we've got that percolator. Never made a latte greater. I'm saving $23 a week. We drive to a house in Preston. We see police arresting a man with his hand in a bag. How's that for first impressions? This place seems depressing. It's a Californian bungalow in a cul-de-sac. It's got a lovely garden and a garage for two cars to park in, or a lot of room for storage if you've just got one. And it's going pretty cheap, you say? Well, it's a decease to stay on the pressed metal ceiling's great. Then I see the handrail in the shower, a collection of those canisters for coffee, tea, and flour, and a photo of a young man in a van in Vietnam. And I can't think of floorboards anymore, whether the front room faces south or north, and I wonder what she bought it for.
I think I speak for the whole panel when I say we've never been this intimidated in our in our careers as culture gabfesters. That was amazing. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was
cheers.
Beautiful. And one of the things I love about that song of to Preston is that, you know, we've just lived through this, like, how defining is real estate and going to look at real estate and talking about fucking real estate. And I mean, it's just become this kind of worldview organizing fact of all of our lives. And through the power of, like, verbal condensation, you really captured the experience of just going to look at a frickin' property, right? But the embedded short story of the lives of the people who lived in the house, and then just through those few details, and then that exactly what a realtor would actually say, right? Just obliterating all of that little embedded gem in this throwaway sentence. And it's just, that song is a fucking work of art. It just isn't, it is, it's a masterpiece. It's like a short story, but it's even more than a short story, right? It's like got novelistic. Anyway, I told you, I can't.
I played that song especially for you because you said your child.
I know.
Something like
it. And the thing is, it was all I could do because when we play it, my daughter sings along to the whole thing, but then I join her an octave down on Cool Half Million. And I was like, just don't do it. Just don't do it. Just don't do it. Like, Melbourne's a nerdy city, but it's not that fucking nerdy. All right. Now that everyone's embarrassed for me, where to start? I have this idea somehow that kind of from your music, but also from some of the interviews I was reading and various things I saw on YouTube, that the world kind of getting what you were doing, right, and kind of picking it up and taking it up and making you suddenly more visible might have been not confusing, but maybe not the most natural mode for you, because a lot of your music is sort of about being both invisible and wanting to be seen. Has it been kind of a crazy blur the last 4-5 years?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's a weird balance between writing songs from that very kind of private personal space, and then I guess secretly everyone wants a bit of attention. But then when it comes, it's kind of terrifying. And that connection, which I guess I didn't think about when I was writing any of the songs or when I write songs now, but yeah, it's nice when people connect, but then it's also kind of, you kind of realize that people are having the same terrors as you.
I read somewhere that you started out as something of a shy singer and it took a while to, And in fact, in some ways, that's surprising because you're a beautiful singer and, right, and now a seasoned performer or whatever. But it's like amazing how many people in the history of rock and roll started out as shy singers, like people you wouldn't expect. Like Jim Morrison had to sing with his back to the audience for a long time. Van Morrison's still, you know, intensely shy and stage frighty. What was it like for you to kind of find a performing voice and become?
Well, it's a weird one because I think it's that idea that, that kind of big idea of what people have of what a great singer is. And I didn't think I fit that mold of like a beautiful kind of, I don't know what it was, but, I would always just play guitar for the singers at school. And I started busking around Hobart with this girl who was a great singer, and I would just play guitar for her because I thought that, that I couldn't sing. And then I started, I wrote a lot of poetry when I was a kid, and I started just kind of, reading it out over music and to see what melody came out of it. And it kind of evolved into something. I don't think I'm a terrible singer, but some people do, but I guess that's personal. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, you gotta call some serious bullshit on anyone who thinks you're not a good singer. But it did, it's funny because it totally informed your songwriting, if I'm not mistaken, that you might have thought that you were not a traditionally great singer, because so much of it is, it has a somewhat spoken quality to it and like a patter quality to it. But it seems as though your music is maybe moving away from that into a more melodic direction. I know you're working on new songs. Is there a different character to them now that you're years and years into this, or?
Yeah, it's just a opera album. The next one.
Jazz standards. Yeah.
I guess it's kind of in the same vein. It definitely kind of moves all over the place, but I felt like my last album, I felt like a lot of the songs would quite different sounding, like stylistically, and I was worried how they would go together, but I think the kind of the idea and the voice brings it all together. But I think the next album, it keeps changing. I think I like so much different music that I sit at the piano at home and I write all these kind of beautiful things that I forget straight away because I don't really know how to play piano, so once I've done it, it's kind of gone. But That's all so nice.
So it hit me listening to your music in very intense bursts. It's kind of been the soundtrack of my Australia trip, and the flight alone gave me a lot of time to hear it. But it struck me that a theme, an ongoing theme in your song seems to be ambivalence. And, I'm thinking of like the song that has the chorus, I want to go out, but I want to stay home, or even Depressed In, the song you just played, this feeling about, you know, being drawn to something, being repulsed by it at the same time. And that is just not a very common emotion in pop music, right? I mean, there's usually rage and passion and kind of pure, intense emotions, and not things like sort of ambivalence and indecision. I don't know if you have anything to say about that observation, but I mean, what do you think ambivalence is doing in your songs and in pop music?
I think I spend a lot of my time kind of dwelling on the kind of purpose and meaning of everything and all those kind of big picture things. But I think I kind of swing really easily between like kind of very, very up and very down, and very like kind of having a purpose and not having a purpose. So I think the songs kind of follow that weird kind of wave.
I have a question about how you figure out whether a particular moment is songable. Like, so many of your songs feature really specific descriptions of particular individual moments, often kind of mundane moments, like that feeling of like, oh, it's time to get dressed to go to the thing, but I don't want to go to the thing, but I don't want to not have gone to the thing. Like the, but, you know, or the great song about ramen packets, or about staring at a wall, like, you really wrote a great song about staring at a wall. How do you, like, but presumably you stare at a wall for, I don't know, 10-20 minutes. Like, how do you, like, when you pick up your mail, how do you know whether this mail pickup moment, like the feeling of opening the envelope, you're like, this is a song. Like, how do you, like, you obviously can't turn every mundane moment of your day into a song, but how do you get the feeling of, oh, this might be a thing, of a thread to pull?
That's a good question. And a lot of the time people are like, write a song about it whenever something happens to me. But I think it's a fine line between finding what is kind of interesting and has a line that goes off it that means something, that's not just, I don't know, evolves into some sort of story or point or like higher kind of meaning. That's not just like, oh, I don't want to get out of bed because that's kind of boring after a while, that repeating that same idea. So I think, yeah, if it blossoms into a bigger thing, then it kind of finds relevance of some
sort.
Do
you feel like you kind of know, do you sort of play with, okay, I'm going to have some thoughts about ramen and sort of see whether that adds up to something, or can you kind of tell whether a moment is inert or rich from the get?
I think sometimes it jumps out. It jumps out and it seems important. That song kind of started as a joke, the ramen song. But then, I don't know, it kind of, I guess it is a bit jokey, but it kind of has a deeper meaning to me anyway.
So this is a little bit away from music, but I'm curious about visual renderings of your music and how that figures in your, you know, process of composition. Like, you designed your album cover. And backstage, you gave us some great merch that was based on little drawings by you. And your videos, when I watch your music videos, seem to have a very strong visual idea. There's one that's animated, right? The Dead Fox video is an animation. Another one has you as a clown in full clown makeup, sadly riding around on little carnival rides. Yeah. Another has you playing, doubles tennis. And so they're narrative, and they also have just a very strong look to them that's sort of witty and silly. And I'm just wondering how much of a hand you have in the way the videos look, for one thing, and also how, you know, the process of drawing, or the fact that you like to draw, fits into being a songwriter.
Yeah, I've played guitar. I think I started playing kind of live when I was 18, before I went to art school in Hobart. But so I kind of started drawing, or I liked the idea of going to art school and learning how to be an artist, but I don't think I really kind of got there. I dropped out and started playing music more. I moved to Melbourne and kind of started doing it more, but I guess they always kind of went together, and the drawing and visual art kind of always just was a extension of ideas. So I write a lot, and then illustration stuff is kind of an extension of those ideas, and videos as well. Like, I kind of have always written out, like when I wrote the last album, I wrote out like these full pages long treatments of videos for each song.
Oh wow.
And it was a bit extreme maybe, but but it was fun, and it kind of stretched the imagination and made me think of everything from different angles and so yeah, I quite enjoy that, and I enjoy seeing that come to life and then kind of, yeah, giving that idea to someone who knows what they're doing, like a director, or and then yeah.
Do the videos follow the path that you laid out in your, yeah, your thinking?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
I had the feeling. I'm glad I asked that question, because I usually don't like music videos as a genre, because they seem like someone else's interpretation of the artist's music. And yours have some kind of, I don't know, they do feel like they kind of burst from the same mind that wrote the songs.
Oh, good.
I mean, it's no Total Eclipse of the Heart, right, Danny?
But that's a good video.
That's, yes.
Steve and I were just exchanging Deathless. It this week.
The truth is, I think I love your music too much to talk about it in a way, bizarrely. I just can't be analytic with it, but it makes me realize every time we've ever had a creator on the show and I've been like a suave host, it was because I basically thought they suck. So I'm out of questions. I don't know what to do. Should we play another song?
Yes.
Oh, that'd
sure.
be awesome.
Okay. Another Melbourne song. Oliver Paul, 20 years old, thick head of hair, worries he's going bald. Wakes up at 9:15, fair of age is way down the 96 tram line. Breakfast on the run again, he's well away. He's dropping soil in seed, Vegemite crumbs everywhere. Sick at the sight of his computer, he dodges his way through the Swanston commuters. Rips off his tie, hands it to a homeless man sleeping in the corner of a metro bus stand. He screams, I'm not going to work today. Gonna count the minutes that the trains run late. Sit on the grass building pyramids out of coke cans. Wielding to the Nicholas building, he trips on a pothole that's not been filled in. He waits for an elevator, 129. A lady walks in, awaits by his side. Her heels are high and her bag is snake skin. Hair pulled so tight you can see her skeleton. Thick as perfume on her breath, a tortoiseshell necklace between her breasts. She looks in up and down with a Botox frown. He's well used to that look by now. The elevator dings and they awkwardly step in. Their fingers touch on the rooftop button. Don't jump, little boy, don't jump off that roof. You got your whole life ahead of you, you're still in your youth. I'd give anything to have skin like you. I think you're projecting the way that you're feeling. I'm not suicidal, just idling insignificantly. I come up here for perception and clarity. I like to imagine I'm playing SimCity. All the people look like ants from up here. And the wind's the only traffic you can hear. He said all I ever wanted to be was an elevator operator. Can you help me, please? Don't jump, little boy, don't jump off that roof. You got your whole life ahead of you, you're still in your youth. I'd give anything to have skin like you. Skin like you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Courtney Barnett.
You guys don't know how long Steve has been fanboying about this segment.
It's just not real. It's just not what just happened to me. It just isn't. All right, I have to collect myself here for a second. All right, moving on. Michael Williams is the director of the Wheeler Center and a contributor to The Guardian and the Sydney Morning Herald, among other publications. He was a host for my new favorite morning radio show, Breakfast on 3RRR. He joins us to talk about travel, cultural stereotyping, and how we form our notions of place and various other things. It's going to be a freewheeling discussion. Michael, come up.
That's a hard act to follow. Sublime to ridiculous, right there.
I was going to say, I'm so sorry, dude.
No. Someone tell me Stephen's been fanboying about this moment as well, please. Because otherwise I'm going to be really deflated.
Yeah, if I host this segment really well and really smoothly, don't take it personally.
Oh, no. Too late. I'm thinking of all your listeners who are going to be recognizing themselves in that statement, going, oh, he never liked what I did.
No. And we'll never get another guest again, of course.
Yeah.
I'm going to set the bar really low here because looking at my notes, I don't think I have a first question. All right. Well, one of the things we were going to talk about is Americans form cultural stereotypes and tend to look at the world through cultural stereotypes. And to that, I just want to say that could be an unfair stereotype of Americans. But first, I'd like to thank you so much for taking us to pet the kangaroos at the zoo today.
There are a lot of intimidating things about being on a stage with you, but one of the intimidating things we had ahead of today was we normally do a field trip. You know, you do a field trip when you go to do a live show. And so we felt we had to impress upon you the breadth of culture that was available in Australia. So we went and we fed some kangaroos.
And then we got avocado toast.
Yeah. Basically, these guys are never buying real estate in Australia because they've eaten avocado toast. But there was something that felt a bit base about that. But it's this extraordinary thing. We're so immersed in US culture. You know, if we visit, I remember the first time I ever went to New York and the shock was familiarity. Like you walk the streets, you can't see a police car without hearing the law and order, dung dung, like the second you see it. You're from Seinfeld to you see a stoop and you think of Sesame Street. It's there. We're immersed in it culturally from a very young age here. And yet we have the inferiority complex of the younger sibling. Our prime minister has a phone call with your president and, leaving aside whether your president knows the prime minister's name, when there is a media story off the back of it, actually the cultural touchstone for most Americans seemed to be the Simpsons Australia episode. That seemed to be about as much thinking about Australia as most Americans
do. We also know about Crocodile Dundee, Foster's Australian for Beer, and Shrimp on the Barbie.
Yeah.
And the Dingo Ate Your Baby. And platypus.
See, I love this. We're joined by the most culturally literate people we can find. And this is where we find ourselves. And so that's what, I guess, with a Melbourne audience here who adore you, who listen to your cultural tips week in, week out, I suspect they want to know what your earliest impressions of Australia are, what the cultural things that you've based your understanding of this place on. Quigley Down Under?
Biographically earliest in our lives.
Yeah.
Right?
Ugh. Well, I began by reading Robert Hughes's The Fatal Shore. Dana.
He was a precocious lad, as we all know, was Master Metcalf. I think I'm going to have to say, and now I'm going to, if he's from New Zealand, I'm going to jump off the edge of the stage, but Steve Irwin on TV.
No, that's absolutely fine. The good news is, if he's from New Zealand but successful, we claim him as Australian anyway. So you would have been completely fine. Steve Irwin, good tip. It's, what was it, what impression did you get of Australia from watching Steve Irwin?
Well, I mean, I think this probably gets to a cultural stereotype about Australians that you also gather in travel, because Australians, I mean, I think just by necessity, because you're so geographically removed from, you know, many parts of the world, are very hardy travelers. And so I do remember when traveling in Europe, not on a Europass, but that sort of bopping from town to town in Europe, coming across Australians who were very hardcore travelers, and you had a little bit of that Steve Irwin quality of just sturdy, you know, like, I've got a backpack and I'm going across Mongolia, you know, that kind of person.
What I like is, if ever there was an audience that was mutually exclusive with that, it's a Melbourne-based podcast crowd. These people have never strapped on a backpack in their lives, but don't be disappointed by that. What about you, Julia?
My earliest encounters with Australia were twofold. One, I went to a girls' summer camp in Maine, in the piney woods of Maine, and some of the same hardy world traveling Australians had been conscripted as girls' camp counselors, and, Jenny taught me swimming. Very robust. And then I loved the movie Strictly Ballroom, which I forget when it came out exactly, but it was probably early 90s, right?
Early 90s, 92, yeah. 93.
I love that movie. And it's obviously not a movie that's about Australia particularly, but I was aware of its Australian provenance and felt that its, like, specificity and interestingness and strangeness made me interested in the place.
I have an answer in a slightly different vein, which is, you know, we're forced to live at the center of this cultural, you know, imperium, in a way. And we get sick of looking at the police siren and hearing dum dum, you know,
and also
somewhat sick of the of the burden of all the associations people have about us as Americans. And there's a part of me that just looks at Canada or Australia with this longing, like a place that has much of what's, if not all of what's actually good about my country, minus all of what bloody sucks about my country, plus universal health care, like,
plus kangaroos,
right, plus adorable fauna, and occasionally exotic fauna. And I think, well, why wouldn't I move there? I mean, it's interesting that the cultural projection, kind of the negative image of what you were kind of sending towards us, is sort of thrown back onto you.
I think there was an essay written in the 1950s by a critic called A.A. Phillips here in Australia called The Cultural Cringe. And it was more concerned with our relationship with England as a relatively young colonial experiment, and the fact that invasion was a recent enough memory, and the trying to build a kind of discrete cultural identity was an exercise that was in the 50s still largely unformed. You'd speak to a certain generation of Australian and they would talk about England as home still. That was fresh enough in the memory. And weirdly enough, now, wherever we are, 60, almost 70 years on, the idea of the cultural cringe is still a pervasive one. We still measure the merit of what we produce based on how it measures up to cultural output from elsewhere, I think. Maybe that's unfair. Because there are endless think pieces. The New York Times has just opened a bureau in Australia. And amongst the things they've done that maybe, not to be critical of them, they get enough from their of that from your president. But one of the slightly tone-deaf things they did was promote the upcoming bureau with endless pictures of a person hanging out of a kangaroo's pouch typing on a keyboard. And
that sounds obviously, cozy.
No, it was gorgeous. And obviously it's gratifying that they've heard of us, so we won't complain. But that's the thing, is that the awareness is kind of in archetypes at best, I guess. And so that's why I'm curious, you know, jokes aside, did you coming here have preconceptions about the kinds of cities that were going to meet you, the kinds of people you were going to be talking with?
Well, I just want to stipulate before we move off the fauna and before you give us too much shit about the fauna, it's on your currency. Like, it's on your coins. You guys are leaning into it. I just want to stipulate, we're not the only idiots who think about
kangaroos. So is the queen. It doesn't mean we like her.
Why is the queen still on your coins?
We're regressive in many ways.
Yeah. But, I mean, the thing that was interesting to me is, and I have a policy generally with travel where I like to not learn about the place before I go there, and that may sound idiotic, but I once went to the Greek islands and had the feeling in my head of like I was comparing to see whether they looked like the Parliament ads. I don't know if you guys had the same ads here, but Parliament cigarettes in the States had this campaign the whole 90s, my whole youth. It was just like beautiful pictures of Mykonos or other Greek islands. And I felt like I was like checking off in my head, like, yes, I have seen the white thing and the blue domes and the green sea and the white sand, like, and the black sand. Like, I just felt so icky. And so when I know I'm going somewhere cool, I just kind of want to wait and have it sprung on me and encounter it fresh. And it's been really amazing this week, spending a few days in Sydney and a few days in Melbourne to kind of get a little bit, you can't help but learn a little bit of like, oh, okay, so Melbourne is like the cultural capital. Okay. So it's kind of an art, it's a music city. It's a coffee city. You sort of build out this set of preconceptions, even if you're trying not to learn too much, that become the hypothesis. And then you have a set of encounters in the city where you're like, well, there sure are a lot of coffee shops and this coffee is delicious. And these people do look creative and all of their jackets are asymmetrical and their scarves are amazing. I must be in a cultural capital. And so I feel great about Melbourne. Like, what a cosmopolitan, amazing, well-coffeed, well-scarved city. These are my people. But I kind of came in looking for it, and we were here, you know, and of course being hosted by a literary temple and introduced to all sorts of magical singing elves of beauty. And like, I'm like, what an incredible place. And then we were in the elevator in the hotel the other night and overheard just like a boring conversation between two boring type people that just were making kind of dumb, mildly homophobic observations about the dinner mate they just left. And I was like, oh, shoot. There are lame people in Melbourne, too. We're just not being introduced to them. So that sense of how you both how you get that hypothesis of a place and then how your specific encounters with the details of a place add up to your sense of it.
Yeah, sure.
So confusing. I mean, even my husband and I went out to Chinese food the other night. And even just the takeout container was just different than the ones we have in New York. It had a clear bottom instead of a black one. It was taller and thinner. And you're just like, oh, so part of the place, part of the sense of place is like this takeout container. If you're from here, this is what a takeout container is to you. And that's part of your sense of travel too.
And it's real. And that's part of, you know, some global capitalist channel that's, you know, supplying the containers, you know, that there is an actual reality that makes material daily existence
right.
different.
Right. Are the plastic regulations here different? Is it that the supply chain goes to China instead? Like, it's like, well, I don't know why it's different, but that gives you that specific sense of place. And that's not part of any hypothesis. So go to Melbourne, the takeout containers are, you won't believe them.
They're on the currency, actually. But no, you gin up a weird confirmation or weird bias that you then go in search of confirmation for, and along the way get hopefully to know the place for what it really is. But I'm curious to throw the question back at you. I mean, there can't be anything in the world that is more, you know, tempting to stereotype, than an American. Right. And so you have hypothesized that we're shallow, provincial, imperial Blythe snobs who come with a completely shallow conception of your culture. But how have we confirmed that for you?
I hope you're not saying I'm wrong, because that,
I think that I just is
well confirmed. No, look, obviously, based on your recent electoral cycle, you're wise people who have who exercise good judgment and understand the world at large. We're much more a classic younger sibling. We revere U.S. culture, or we revere the best of it. We're not naive about, I think, the breadth of it and the way in which so much of it. I think there's a period of kind of rampant anti-Americanism, possibly amongst the Australian kind of smug in a city for a little while there. But I think by and large, as culture gets increasingly globalized, we look to the best examples of things. And one of the nice things, for example, about American TV at the moment is that the breadth of channels from which it comes, whether it's streaming, whether it's smaller studios, the fact that it's not monolithic in the way that maybe it was a few years ago, I think means that we turn to it. We talk about the golden age of TV just as much as you do, and we're probably talking overwhelmingly about American product when we do it. And I think that's interesting. We don't assume the worst. We assume that both the best and worst, the extremes, are what we're going to have available to us. The other thing I would say is cultural criticism in this country is languishing in lots of different ways. Our conventional media is struggling. It's struggling to be enough outlets for decent criticism, decent reviewing. We have extraordinary writers, extraordinary filmmakers, extraordinary artists in all different genres. And they might have two or three places where their work gets reviewed. There are so few avenues to hear it talked about in the kind of depth that we get out of a Gabfest episode. And so that's what we look to you for. That's why we're excited, is in-depth, meaningful discussion about culture is something of a revelation, I think. But
and when we one day have one, it'll be a revelation for us too. All right. Well, we have to invite Michael to stay and endorse, right?
Please.
Will you please?
Well, it'll be a pleasure.
Lovely. Well, now's the moment in our podcast where we endorse Dane. What do you have?
An extra long N for a live show. All right. So I was trying to pick something Australian again for my endorsement, as I did in our Sydney show. And Steve, I'm wondering, I'm going to flash a book at you. I'm wondering if you have any particular associations with this name right here.
Oh my God. That man, he is the Courtney Barnett of freaking geniuses that I admire and want to be like. I love Clive James. I mean, no one can write like him. No one can talk like him. He was both a broadcaster and a critic, and he's a wonderful poet. I mean, just the greatest. Dana and I, right, I was talking out of school, but one night we were so lucky to go out to dinner with Clive James, and it was just, he was just the rock hunter to end all rock hunters. He couldn't believe the, like, golden nuggets that just spill out of his mouth every time he opens it.
You just did my intro for me.
Were you really going to say golden nuggets? Just out of curiosity.
Well, I mean, the thing that I would remark about that, about meeting him in person, is that the quality that comes across on the page in his writing was completely there in conversation as well, which was this combination of erudition and just utter self-deprecating, scabrous humor. You know, so he was sort of twinkling and witty and lovely, but not for a moment was he kind of snobbish or in love with himself, right? He was just an utter delight to be around. So Clive James, if you know anything about his story, in addition to being a poet, critic, novelist, broadcaster, he's also a translator. He's translated Dante. He's written song lyrics, and he's a really good poet. And especially now, later in his life, he's written a few wonderful volumes of poetry. 6 years ago, when he was diagnosed with some form of leukemia that was likely to be terminal in the near future, he wrote a book of poems called Sentence to Life that was, you know, essentially kind of a goodbye to the world. It was heartbreaking and beautiful. And, but he got 6 more years, and he's still alive and still doing okay and still writing. And he has a new book of poems called Injury Time that I picked up in Sydney. And, And the wonderful thing about these poems is that, you know, the last book had this elegiac quality of, you know, here I am putting down my very last words. And this book in many places almost makes fun of that self, you know, of that person who was ready to say goodbye to the world. But wait, I got six more years and, you know, I still have some more thoughts about things. And so these poems are both kind of elegiac and heartbreaking at times and also very funny and, very, very aware of kind of pop culture from all eras, from classic Hollywood to YouTube. In fact, there's a couple poems about YouTube here. But I'm going to read a poem. Let me find it here. That made me cry on the plane. Steve, sitting next to you, you were sleeping, so you didn't know. A poem that he wrote to his granddaughter. And, maybe the reason it made me cry is that it's about her gymnastics and my daughter is a gymnast too. So this is called Front Flip Half Twist. In the video from Wales, my granddaughter steps to the wall's edge. Just a yard below, the beach begins, a long way from the water. A pause for thought. She then proceeds to throw a cartwheel through the air, and when she lands, stand upright on the sand, all done, no hands. She came to her miraculous mastery of this maneuver by a strict process. She still insists it was no mystery. Of more and more to reach down less and less, until one day the finished thing was there, made manifest entirely in midair. I, who can fly no longer, feel I'm flying when I watch her describe that graceful arc, so perfectly alive. I can't be dying if I see this. The sky will not grow dark while she spins through it, setting it alight, making my day by staving off the night. Play it again. A poem that has taken its final form is radiant like this. Beginnings left behind, but not forsaken, is history beyond analysis. What starts by growing slowly like a pearl takes off and turns into a whirling girl.
Like a pearl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something I would just note about that poem that I wanted to say beforehand, and maybe you hear it in the reading, is that he has this ability to do something that's really rare in poetry. Actually, it's something that Lin-Manuel Miranda can do too, where he writes a perfectly conversational sentence and yet it rhymes perfectly. So you almost don't notice that that poem rhymes until you start reading it out loud. Yeah, it's wonderful.
Absolutely.
We sometimes have an ambivalent relationship with our expatriate artists when they go elsewhere, but Clive James's voice is so distinctive and so distinctively Australian. And when you read him on the page and when you, even you hear someone else read it, the accent kind of comes through and there's something very kind of familiar and beautiful about that. My favorite poem of his has the line, which is similarly conversational: the book of my enemy has been remaindered and I am glad.
That was awesome. Julia Turner, what do you have?
I'm going to recommend something that I have technically already recommended to the Plus membership. When we talked about books that people must read a few weeks ago.
Disallowed.
But it's
what's your fallback?
I'm not doing the fallback.
You do have a fallback. Yeah.
I do, but I'm not doing it, Steve. You can't cow me. I've seen Wonder Woman. it's just so pertinent to our final conversation with Michael that I had to do it. So one of my favorite books is a book that's actually kind of uncharacteristic for me to like because it's very gauzy and sort of theoretical and, just not as sturdy as the stuff I'm usually drawn to. It's the book Invisible Cities by Italo Calvino. And it's a bunch of imagined conversations between Kublai Khan and Marco Polo. And Kublai Khan says, Marco, please tell me about all the cities you visited. And then there's just a set of very teensy tiny stories where he describes each city. But my favorite is the passage where he describes the city of Pira, because it's about that sense of what you think something is before you encounter it. And I'm just going to read a brief passage. For a long time, Pira, to me, was a fortified city on the slopes of a bay, with high windows and towers, enclosed like a goblet, with a central square deep as a well, with a well in its center. I had never seen it. It was one of the many cities where I had never arrived that I had conjured up through its name, Euphrasia, Odile, Margara, Catulia. Pira had its place among them, different from each of them, and like each of them, unmistakable to the mind's eye. The day came when my travels took me to Pira. As soon as I set foot there, everything I had imagined was forgotten. Pyrrha had become what is Pyrrha, and I thought I had always known that the sea is invisible from the city, hidden behind a dune of the low rolling coast, that the streets are long and straight, that the houses are clumped at intervals, not high, and they are separated by open lots with stacks of lumber and with sawmills, that the wind stirs the veins of the water pumps. From that moment on, the name Pyrrha has brought to my mind this view, this light, this buzzing, this air, in which a yellowish dust flies. Obviously, the name means this and could mean nothing but this. My mind goes on containing a great number of cities I have never seen and will never see, names that bear with them a figure or a fragment or a glimmer of an imagined figure. The city high above the bay is also there still with a square enclosing the well, but I can no longer call it by a name nor remember how I could ever have given it a name that means something entirely different. It's a great book. You should read it.
That was beautiful, but are you ready for the ultimate dick move?
Sure.
Genghis Khan, not Kublai Khan.
I think it's the reverse.
Is it really Kublai Khan? Did I get double reverse dick moved on myself?
Possibly. All right, we'll look it up. We'll look it up.
I was really hoping the ultimate dick move would have been Calvino was telling me when I asked him about that book. Like I was hoping for a name drop, but Genghis Khan was not where I thought you were going.
No, yeah. Calvino always hated that book his worst. Yeah. Michael, what do you have?
I've cheated a bit because I've got a book for each of you. So it Ooh. Struck me that when we have preconceptions of a culture, there's no better way past it than to read the literature of that place. And there are so many extraordinary Australian writers, some of whom travel internationally and are published elsewhere, and others of whom don't. And I think, Dana, you said it when talking about why Courtney is such an extraordinary artist, that capacity for specificity, for writing about your world in a specific place in kind of intimate detail and not caring if the people on the other side of the world have heard of Preston because you know they're going to understand it at a kind of personal level, is what characterizes our best literature. So I've chosen three books amongst many for each of you. I've got Elizabeth Harrower's The Watchtower for you, Stephen. Harrower wrote this back in the 60s and the book came out, was quite well received and then disappeared without a trace, went out of print as so many works of Australian literature do. It's an extraordinary, beautiful, psychological literary work about two sisters and it is a masterpiece. Harrower is still alive and is in her late 80s and has suddenly had this kind of career revival as she's been discovered again. And she's an extraordinary Australian writer and will give you a different idea of Sydney. Not an altogether pleasant one, which is unfortunate. but you can't control these things sometimes. Dana, for you, I've chosen Kenneth Cook's Wake and Fright. If you haven't seen the film is truly disturbing.
I have not seen it.
There's a whole lot of really sick people in the audience. This is a book that we couldn't recommend to you before you came to Australia because you never would have come, but it captures themes of Australian masculinity and alcoholism and is kind of miserable and depraved and about the city and the outback and what lies beneath the veneer of Australian hospitality. And it's a whole lot of fun.
We'll read it on the plane back.
Yeah, read it when you're leaving us, not before we say, just one more beer, Dana. It'll be fine. And Julia, I've chosen Helen Garner's The Spare Room. Helen Garner is an extraordinary Australian writer. Hey, excellent. That may be Helen in the audience. Hi. If ever there's a human being who never hooted the sound of their own name, it's Helen Garner. She is an extraordinary writer and a really amazing essayist and journalist. This is actually one of her novels, but it is a beautiful story about a protagonist whose name is Helen, many of whose biographical details match the author's, but who has a friend who's dying of cancer and who she's spending time with. And it's a beautiful book. And if you like it, I suggest you go to the journalism and essays as well. So three books, just because your luggage, I know, is already full of plush toys of Australian animals. Put this on top and look a little more respectable. So
thank you so much.
I note that all three endorsements have gotten applause, rounds of applause. So I'm watching you, Melbourne. So I occasionally do travel writing, and I feel as though, and I try to go naive. I try not to gin up any biases to be confirmed before I go to a place, and I try to look for something elemental in the way people walk, or, you know, or a quality of light or something. And I think my finest moment was when I went to Buenos Aires, and I was walking along, and the wind was coming off the plata, and it was so freshening, and I felt at that moment I was in this place, that the spirit of the place was kind of animating my experience at last. And I took out my notebook and my pen, and I wrote down, I wonder if Buenos Aires is known for its good air? Question mark. And I looked at the sentence, and I just shook my head and said, I fucking suck as much as people think I fucking suck. And I quietly put the notebook back in my pocket. So with that in mind, I do feel as though I, in addition to the completely mind-bending jet lag that you get when you come from the United States to Australia, once you start to get over that, you realize that you're seasonally mirrored, right? And I was walking around today or yesterday or one of the days, and you get that first really serious hint of sweater weather and a little glancing winter light. And that was when I had this unmistakable sense of where I was. And it reminded me of one of the things that I love most in the world. To me, the most characteristic thing about the Lucksmiths isn't the bounciness or wit of their music, but it's that many of their songs right towards the end of them suddenly slow down. They actually change time signature, and they become contemplative, and they drop a lyric of such piercing melancholy on you. And I felt before I ever came to Melbourne that I knew something true and not biased about your city because of that music. I am here to tell you that they are just truly one of the great bands. I've been proselytizing for them for probably close to 15 or 20 years now in the United States. And I think there may be a Lucksmith or two in the audience, but I just want to tell you, your music has meant, I mean, I think I might cry. Like, your music has meant so much to me. And this is actually a true story. I discovered it at Kim's Video on West 4th Street in Manhattan. It was just playing over the thing. And I was like, this is fucking awesome. What is this? And I bought the CD. I went on, this was like 2001. And I was like, who are these guys? And I went on the internet, and you were playing that night at, where would it have been? Like one of those great downtown grungeo venues. And I went and saw you. It was one of the best shows I've ever seen. So face to face, if you are actually in the audience, I love your music. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. It really has improved my life immeasurably. Thank you. Michael, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Julia, thank you.
I looked it up. It was Kubla.
That was
a slow-mo Wonder Woman own right there.
I knew it was Kubla all along, and I did that just for you. Dana, thank you so much.
As always.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page at slate.com/culturefest. You can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our intern is Dana Schrader. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lickteig. And Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network. The Culture Gab Fest is part of the Panoply Network. You can check out an entire roster of like and unlike shows at panoply.fm. Our Twitter feed is @SlateCultFest. Melbourne, you fucking rock. I love it here. Thank you so much for coming out to see our show. Fire like overblown libretto in a sumptuous score.